welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am your host, Rebecca Christie, here today to talk about Bruegel's debate in partnership with the Financial Times on the upcoming European elections. We have with us to discuss this event that we held in Brussels, Andy Bounds from the Financial Times, who moderated the event, and Heather Graby, one of Bruegel's best fellows on political affairs and the political outlook. I'm really excited to get your thoughts on how this is coming together. This is the first time for me anyway to hear all six of these different political party groups really lay out where they stand and what they're going to be campaigning on as we head into these elections in June. Heather, would you like to just set the scene for us and people coming into this now?
It was a really interesting debate because of what was there and what was not there. There was a lot about Europe. Should we have more Europe or less Europe? Mostly more, apart from ID, who were arguing for less. But what exactly does that mean? Where should Europe be more active? There was a huge amount of talk about competitiveness, not surprising, given we have Mario Draghi's report coming up. Enrico Letta's just produced his on the single market. But what is the competitiveness for? There wasn't much of a vision for the future European economy. Where will Europe's comparative advantages lie in 10 or 20 years' time? We didn't hear much about that at all. It was mainly slogans. Everybody's in favor of jobs. Everybody's in favor of skills. So am I. Yeah, understandable. But how do we get there? And what are the strategies? What are the choices that need to be made? I didn't feel as a voter that I had much of a sense of what kind of economic vision I would be voting for from each of these parties. The left party really pushed for on monetary policy. It's all about the IMF and the ECB and the international financial institutions, but it wasn't about taxes, which I found really weird. And ID, the far right, it was about the nation state is more important, Europe is doing too much. But there was nothing on migration, which is on the stump, their key selling point. So it was a bit of a strangely abstract debate. And I was left as a voter thinking at the end, okay, how would I choose between these parties? And it wasn't the parties. I think it was more about which topic is most important to me and which one represents that topic. So I think it's probably going to be more of a sort of identitarian debate.
Makes a lot of sense given the role that the European Parliament plays with the national parliaments and the national capitals. I mean, taxes is such a national competence. There's not much that can be done at the EU level and really nothing by the parliament. Whereas some of these other issues are areas where if you vote for someone who has your personal preferred interest, whether that's agriculture or foreign investment or something like that, your people might be able to make a difference. And I want to remind listeners that it's not clear in a lot of these countries who you're voting for when you vote for your European Parliament choice. You basically pick a party and then they pick from a list. Now, some countries like Ireland do have very clear candidates, but others like Belgium, which is the country in which I vote, couldn't tell you. I just have to pick someone whose platform aligns with my views. So with that, Andy, you have a great seat here to survey the landscape and really weigh in on what people can think about this. Can you just break down for us who these six groups are and what their chunks of policy are looking like?
Yeah, I mean, I was really pleased that we got six out of the seven political families in the parliament on the stage. So we had everything from the French communists talking to the left to someone from the AfD in Germany on the far right. And we obviously had the main centrist parties as well. So I was pleased with that. So we had Thanasis Bourkalis from the European People's Party, which is von der Leyen's party, whose message was very much more of the same with some slight tweaks. You know, we've had a great record. We dealt with COVID. We did the rebooted the economy after that through the Next Gen EU fund. We did the Green Deal. Now we need to ally the Green Deal with a bit more competitiveness and make sure it helps our companies, not hurts them. Then we had going on, from what I remember left to right, we had Maria João Rodrigues from the Party of European Socialists, a former Portuguese minister, who I'll probably summarize her views along with Rasmus Nordqvist from the Greens, because they were quite similar, which is basically more investment on a pan-European level. You know, let's raise another fund, a bit like the RRF, to fund the green transition.
That's the European Recovery and Resilience Fund.
Yeah, which was the post-COVID one. And then we had, you know, the classic Arthur Finn from the Liberal Foundation, who gave the sort of, I mean, it's interesting what Heather said earlier about the sort of, you know, the specifics, because I found myself nodding with a lot of what she said, but then saying some of it might not be mutually compatible, in the sense that, you know, we want to be tough on China, but we also want to be open to investment. And, you know, this is where we're going to get into what are the actual trade-offs that these people are going to have to make. And then, yeah, Dirk Friedrich from the ID party, who was, you know, as Heather said, you know, small state. Some of his specific policies were, you know, stop the combustion engine ban, basically get off people's backs with the Green Deal, don't force households to change the way they heat their homes, what cars they drive, because that's damaging our economy. And then finally, we had Frédéric Barcaro from the European left, French communist, who, again, was all about more spending. And we can do it through monetary, you know, creation, effectively, as we've seen for the last few years. What I didn't get a sense of is economic growth. You know, one of our first questions was, how do we get the economy growing? Do we want the economy to grow? And if we do, you know, and people mentioned how the European economy has shrunk as a total of the global economy. People talked about that. But nobody, apart from this green pivot, you know, and how we could fund that and become world leading, I didn't hear a lot. And improve people's skills and all these, you know, all these quite difficult issues from an economic point of view, I find. I mean, people talk about skills, you know, for decades. And again, a lot of it's national policy, and they still struggle to do it. So I think, you know, the scale of the transition is probably, you know, vast and more vast than maybe some of these political parties are willing to tell people.
Thank you so much for that. That was a really helpful way to start thinking about not just the party groups, but the groups of the party groups. The polls, as they've been coming into shape, show that the EPP and the socialists, the mainstream socialists, are probably going to be, once again, the two largest party groups in the parliament. Their numbers will stay more or less as they are now. And then the race is on for third. The three parties in the race for third, as I understand it, are Renew, which is the Liberals, as you said, and then Identity and Democracy, the ID far-right party, and the European Conservatives and Reformists, who are the other right-wing party. They are the ones who were not here on this list. And I've been hearing in town that there's, from the people on the inside, no one thinks they're going to be able to form a right-wing super party and take over. From the outside, it's like, oh, two right-wing parties. Why wouldn't they get together and do something like what the U.S. Republicans have done? But within the policy sphere, people say, look, these come from different countries. They have different key issues. They're sometimes at polar ends of the spectrum on things like Israel or Russia. So it's, in a sense, it's going to be every party within the party for themselves. Andy, is that what you think? And do we have an explanation for why ECR isn't here, or did it just scheduling didn't work out?
I think, yeah, with them, it was, scheduling issues and finding somebody at the right time. I couldn't tell you. We tried very hard, and they had an opportunity. I think they are going through a internal debate about who they want to be. I mean, for example, they allowed Eric Zemmour's party from France, which some would say is further right than Le Pen, who sits in the ID group, to join their group because they're looking for numbers, and numbers count in the European Parliament. So I think some of these differences, even Russia and so on, I mean, ECR is talking about allowing Viktor Orban's Fidesz to join. And, you know, his stance on Russia is very different to the Polish, for example, who are in the ECR. So, you know, I think this will all be resolved after the elections. People will look at the numbers and they'll say, if I have enough, you know, if I get these guys in and I bite my tongue, do I become third? You know, and then they will try to have a sway on the two big parties that will be forming the government. And that will, you know, mean, so the future of the Green Deal, for example, will slightly depend on, you know, the numbers, and the ECR will want to reduce it. But if instead Renew comes third, they may, you know, commit to changing it a little bit, but roughly continuing.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Green Deal. The Greens, of course, are expected to lose seats, but that assumes that the party alliances stay as they are. And one development I saw was that Italy's five-star party was thinking about joining the Greens. Now, they're a very spontaneous actor in political circles, so they may or they may not. But if they did, one poll I saw suggested the Greens wouldn't lose any seats at all on net. So, Heather, you guys had a lot of interesting discussion in the debate about the Green outlook. What ideas did you hear, and how do you think this fits?
I had a lot of support for continuing the Green Deal, and I think a key point made several times by both ALDE and also, so interestingly, by the Liberals, as well as by the Greens, it was one point on which they really agreed, was you can't turn back from the Green Deal because businesses have already invested so much in it. It would be a huge loss for European business. And this need to keep consistency was really quite strong. Where I heard a lot of flip-flopping was much more from EPP. So obviously they voted in the Parliament against and campaigned against the Nature Restoration Law last autumn. And there was lots of questions about, is the EPP turning against the Green Deal? They've subsequently then pulled back behind it, maybe because Ursula von der Leyen was confirmed as their candidate to be the next Commission president. So then they need to support continuity, and she's the one who's led this. But what you hear a lot of it, and we heard in this debate as well, is, well, maybe it's gone too far. We should be allying it also with some kind of package on competitiveness, and we should make sure that the investment is there. So sure, for sure, the investment needs to be there, but the public-private mix of that is still a very big political and economic policy choice to be made. And by signaling, hey, we might roll back on some of this, they are sending then the signal against private investment. So it's a tricky one, and it's clearly one where they're trying to campaign against the far right and pick up some of the anti-Green vote and some of the concerns about, okay, how is the Green Deal really going to play out for households, for consumers, for farmers, and so on, without abandoning the whole thing. But as in the debate, we heard quite clearly, if you're thinking about this as a transition for the economy, one which is going to lead to a different kind of economy, then you're only going to get the job creation in the new sectors, in clean tech and in circular economy and so on, if it continues. So there's an ambivalence there, which will be very important in the next parliament, because it's the EPP as the largest group and probably forming some kind of grand coalition, which would need to keep going in terms of implementation, pushing at EU level for implementation in order to meet the targets. So if they go soft, that could hollow out the Green Deal, and it could mean that the EU then doesn't meet the targets in the next term.
That's really interesting. When we come back, we'll get more into the policy agenda. Welcome back. Andy, what did you think were the most important policy topics that came up?
Well, picking up on the point about the Green Deal, China was very interesting because, you know, we've sort of woken up in Europe to the fact that the Green Deal is partly China's deal. You know, the solar panels are coming from China, the electric vehicles are coming from China. They've been steadily putting the money in, sometimes through vast subsidies, to create these industries of the future, which Europe said the Green Deal would create. So now we have a dilemma of, do we import cheaply from China to hit these targets, for example, renewable energy targets, or do we protect our markets and put up barriers? And we had quite an interesting exchange about economic security, which is something that the European Union is looking at. Now, this is very much a competence of member states who invest in your country, but they're trying to do more on an EU level, because they fear sort of Chinese divide and rule, in the sense that, you know, if one country says, well, we don't want Chinese car factories, another country will quite happily say, yes, we do. So they're trying to sort of create a united front. And we saw the early stages of this. And, you know, again, Alva from the Liberals said, you know, we should not be selling ports to China. Now, 5 years ago, everybody was selling ports to China, and it was orthodox policy in the EU. So to me, it shows how far the debate has changed. And even, the EPP was not pushing back against that. Thanasis Bourkalis is from Greece. Piraeus is owned by the Chinese. And, you know, he sort of seemed to be saying maybe we wouldn't say yes. You know, 20 years ago, we said yes. So I think this whole debate of how we deal with China, you know, it's so critical to our supply chains and so critical to our exports as well, you know, a lot of EU goods. And, you know, I think politicians are struggling, and we will see this, whatever happens in the next mandate, to work out a way to recalibrate the relationship without, you know, causing massive disruption.
And I think also it's very tricky on the jobs issue, because when Chinese companies have bought European companies but kept the jobs in Europe, think about, you know, Volvo getting bought, for example, that seems to be kind of okay, because it doesn't scare people so much as a China shock where the jobs move to China. But now that we start to look at ownership of critical infrastructure, so the ports point is key, but also issues like, okay, what does that mean for our digital infrastructure, for telecoms companies? What does that mean for if we have electric vehicles from China, connected cars, where the data then goes back to China, what does that mean? So this recalibration that Andy was just talking about has a long way to run still. I think it's going to be a defining feature of the next term of the EU institutions, is working out what really is economic security. And in this debate, we heard it, economic security was largely about jobs and about ensuring that companies can continue to thrive. But then, okay, but does it matter who owns those companies if they're located in Europe? That's still an issue that hasn't really been worked out, where there are very different views across the member states. And I think that's also a key point about this debate. We're hearing at European level a kind of abstraction of very complex national debates, because these are very big tent party groupings. Who encompass national parties with a wide spectrum of views. What's right and what's left in different European countries means completely different things. You know, the Swedish Moderaten, for example, are to the left of many others. But then you get others who, in some countries, which are now competing with the far right very actively and taking on some of their economic policies, including nationalism. So that's why you get some of these very broad slogans at European level, which can be quite hard to decipher for the voters, because the true economic policy choices are being thrashed out still, both through the recalibration and also because many of them are about national level competences.
Yeah, the debate really showed the serpentine nature of some of these. I mean, you had the guy from the left saying, we're looking too much at trade in material products. And of course, if you look at services, that's where the EU is a leader. That's where they're doing more exporting. You had the liberals really, I thought, very clearly laying out the different sides of the debate. We want growth and we need to import the products. We're worried about security. We're worried about the environment. If we, some of the things that give us alternatives also hurt us in other ways by, say, you know, speeding up deforestation in the Amazon. And the socialist message was very similar to the liberal message, which was striking to me. How much do you think the parliament will shape what happens toward China, and what should we take away from this?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I still think the sort of member states are in the driving seat, and national governments. And we've seen, you know, Olaf Scholz was in China this week and signs a, you know, memorandum of understanding on developing technology for electric vehicles, where there's other people, you know, worried about exactly what Heather talked about, you know, Chinese control of electric vehicles and the data being kept in China of where we're all driving and how we're driving. So I think there's still huge differences among member states. They've moved a little bit more China skeptic as a group, but there's still a massive range. And I think in a way, Parliament's job tends to be as a sort of sounding, a lightning rod for sort of public feeling. So I think we saw that with the farming debate. You know, it was the Parliament that first started making a fuss about nature restoration law, about pesticides. You know, and then the farmers came out on the streets, and then the council and the ministers and the government started to backtrack, and the Commission. So I think with China, the most obvious place for the Parliament to sort of influence things is on trade policy. You know, the EU has developed a lot of new instruments to hit China with and to hit Trump with if Trump returns, defensive instruments. And I think, you know, Parliament will be pressuring them to use those to exert, you know, the power of the EU and the single market. We're seeing some of those cases coming through now. And on trade policy generally, I mean, the Parliament has actually also always been quite a free trade leaning body and has generally approved. It's not European Parliament that blocks trade deals. It's the national parliaments. But I think they're losing that as they become more, you know, as they become more diversified, you know, more groups in there. And ironically, you know, groups like the ECR are quite open free traders, whereas groups like the Greens are now turning against free trade. So the coalitions on trade are quite typical. And we saw that with the Mercosur Pact, you know, which many economists would say is vital, you know, for the Green Deal to get access to raw materials, but has been founded over the over deforestation and farmers' concerns about imports of beef, you know, so I think we're in a bit of a. I see the whole trade agenda stalling. It was very notable that only things really said about trade in this debate were quite negative. There's always this talk about we need to diversify, we need to reduce our reliance on China. Well, if we don't produce those minerals in the EU. Many of them we don't, or we're not prepared to, we have to get them somewhere else. Nobody was talking about where else we might get them.
There was a poll question for all the folks following along where they said, do you agree or disagree the EU needs to trade less with China? And it was very close. 52% said, no, we don't need to trade less with China. 39% said, yes, we do. 8% weren't sure. The gentleman from the ID party, he said, this is squaring the circle. This is a really impossible choice to ask people to make. And he gave what I thought was a pretty clear overview of what people are frustrated about. He said, you know, people would like an electric car, but maybe they can't afford one. On the other hand, energy is so expensive just to heat their homes. How do we address these frustrations? And that was a very pragmatic way to talk about how angry people are. What did you make of that?
Both the far right and the far left in this debate referred a great deal to the negative side of globalization felt by Europeans. So they talked about a lot of issues to do with left behindism. So people feeling that their incomes have actually not improved, that their job is not safe, that they're being forced to make major changes because of all of the transitions that are going on without any real social guarantees. And this constant referring to, you know, why are governments putting requirements on people without supporting them? The need for an accompaniment shows that the deal part of both the Green Deal, but also the kind of social deal is still very much absent. Now, partly that's because the tools for that are at national level, not at EU level. The EU doesn't give out unemployment insurance, for example. The EU doesn't give out income guarantees. It doesn't even set minimum wages. So that part of it is a problem, that it's still the EU that brings up the regulatory requirements and many of the burdens, and it's not the EU that hands out the goodies that kind of make that more manageable and palatable in your life. So I think that's an ongoing problem. The EU level is going to get blamed for difficult measures, which the national leaders are always more comfortable for the EU to take, because then they don't have to take the blame. But it's very tricky, because it means that then you end up with a delegitimization of those measures. And when you've got these major transitions, as we saw with globalization, when people get really angry about the effects of it, it's this amorphous sense of the establishment and the elite and not really knowing who was responsible, that then actually tars the whole elite, including the democratically elected elite, which gets blamed for it. And that's why you get so much populism, both on the far right and the far left. And this kind of blaming of the powers that be and the institutions, we heard that very strongly, both from the far right, far left. And that's where I think the centrist parties have really got to get their act together and be clearer about what's the deal. How are people going to cope with these things? And at the moment, there's still a lot of vagueness. Oh, well, we need to have another just something fund at EU level. But we know that the amount of money available at EU level is really quite small. So we didn't even get into issues like, should the EU budget get bigger? They're not even debating that yet because that's too sensitive. And the sense of what has the EU done for me is still not really answered.
When we come back, we'll talk about what governing could look like under these conditions. Andy, how do you think the next parliament is going to work with the member states and with the European Commission, whether Ursula von der Leyen stays at the top of it or not?
Well, for a start, they will have a vote on who does become the head of the European Commission. So von der Leyen is still the favourite because her EPP party will win the most votes. But she has to find support probably to be sure, slightly outside her natural home of Socialist EPP Renew, because some of those parties have already said they won't vote for her. Even her own French component of the EPP has said they won't vote for her. And I think what we're seeing now is a lot of national cleavages, as Heather referred to earlier. So everyone's in campaign mode. So every group in the parliament is saying, well, normally I'd cooperate with these people from the Socialists, but I'm fighting them tooth and nail back home. So, you know, and then it's a question of whether those groups kind of re-coalesce afterwards. But it will be a more volatile parliament. It will be a more restrained commission, I think, and a probably, you know, we're not, as we're saying, we're not really hearing ambitious proposals at the moment. You know, we're hearing about sort of head down, try and get what's already there working better. You know, nobody's really going out there saying, you know, apart from on the extremes, we need I think we will probably be debating about a new fund for defense and a new sort of common borrowing instrument for technology. But, you know, we had that debate with the STEP fund about 6 months ago, and member states didn't want to put the money in. So why they would put the money in after this election, where there might be even more pressure on their budgets, I'm not quite sure. So I think it'll be less ambitious. I think it'll be slightly, you know, slightly duller and sort of like very much, we have the letter report coming out. You know, we've had we've got the Draghi report coming. It's very much going to be looking at what sort of policies, quite dull policies, can we do to actually improve life for European businesses so that they can provide some more growth, so that we then have the fruits of growth to spread around. I mean, that's, you know, you can't magic this money from nowhere, despite what, you know, I think our French communist friend, Frédéric, you know, he good luck to him, because, you know, he thinks we can create enough money supply to solve these problems. But failing that, it's the hard yards of actually improving the competitiveness of the economy. And if you talk to businesses, they will be looking in those two reports from Letta and Draghi at practical steps to make their life easier so that they can sell their goods. Because we're nowhere there with services, but we're not even there with goods. You know, there are lots of barriers still to companies who want to expand from one member state to the other. Whereas, you know, other in the US and China and Asia and other countries, they build up the scale in their own domestic market, then they come to Europe and they can be more competitive than European companies because they struggle to build the same scale across the European market.
When you talk about a volatile parliament, do you mean one that just tries to block everything, or do you mean one that is unpredictable yet might be very actively influential in some areas?
I think, yeah, one that is more unpredictable, one that has different coalitions for different policies. One that probably does less, you know, because we had a huge legislative agenda for the last 5 years, and one that probably, but I think is more, it still plays that role as a lightning rod connecting with the electorate and with the people. And I think that probably does lead to blocking more things, to be fair.
I think a really interesting question is how the challenger parties, particularly the populist radical right, will behave once they become MEPs. If, for example, they become the third largest party and the primary one, which is against this kind of super grand coalition at the start. And this is not a foretold conclusion at this point. But if that were to happen, the big question is whether they show up. Lots of radical right MEPs elected in the past never actually come to the parliament. They don't play much of a role. They don't go into the committees. They don't write reports. They don't actually take up the positions of power where the parliament really can block things and do things. They might use it for grandstanding, and they'll certainly use the funds available to MEPs for campaigning, sometimes in national elections, illegally, and we've seen all kinds of corruption problems as well there too. So the question is, will they at this point take that role of actually using the parliament's power more seriously, and will they hold together? So the volatility is very much there in these two groups, ID and ECR, where some parties haven't decided which one they'll join. For example, Fidesz, the Hungarian ruling party might switch allegiances. They often move in and out of those groupings. They're often quite volatile internally, these parties, and they may split with, you know, one charismatic leader taking off some of them. So it's hard to see them pulling together as a group. Whereas, for example, the EPP, the source of its great strength is not only numbers, it's what it does with those numbers. It's very disciplined about voting together, even though it's a big tent with many different views. They're internally very disciplined in the parliament. That's absolutely not the case with the radical right. So will they decide to just pick and choose certain issues, which is typically what they do in national level? You know, they just go out on migration, for example, or on a particular issue. And so they might use the parliament for grandstanding. We might hear a lot of noise from the parliament, but not a lot of, you know, a lot of bark, but not a lot of bite in terms of actually changing things. So that's, I think, the big question. And that's where the mainstream parties may find themselves increasingly contested at a rhetorical level, but then they just continue with business as usual.
I just slightly disagree with that. From the point of view of the ECR, which, you know, the ID, fair enough, they're disruptors. They don't want to participate, and others don't want to participate them with. But ECR provides committee chair people. It provides rapporteurs. It does voting deals. It signs joint letters. And their aim is to pull the EPP over towards them and offer them an alternative. And if the ECR gets big enough, and if they get Fidesz, and they can hold together and keep some of the people who might be uncomfortable with Fidesz, such as the Flemish nationalists or the Czechs, and they govern. We have Giorgia Meloni. We discussed before we came on air. You know, she is governing responsibly from an EU perspective and economically responsibly, and she wants to change Europe, and so does Orbán. And therefore, I think they will be a more disciplined kind of unified group. And you have the Poles in there as well, the PiS, who've governed. So I think. There, and then it's a question of how big they become and whether, that's what I was saying, there are different coalitions. So on some things, the EPP might go with them. On other things, they might go to the left.
Heather, what do these elections mean for the rest of the world?
That really depends on how far it's the European Parliament that determines how the Commission acts and also how it interacts with the Council and the changing, the national elections which are coming up. Because I think the biggest change in terms of what we were just discussing, the challenger parties, is where the national elections bring more of these parties to power at national level. And as Andy was just saying, in Italy, Giorgia Meloni has proved to be a constructive player at European level, also on foreign policy, which is really important. The fact that she has supported NATO and particularly support for Ukraine has been really important. That could have gone very differently. And if we have a French election which brings Rassemblement National to power, that would change things absolutely enormously. So I think Russia-Ukraine is one really key thing to watch. And there, I don't think it's not these European Parliament elections that are going to make a big difference. It's the national elections. On China, the big question is whether it's going to be mainly about the geopolitics or the geoeconomics. 5 years ago, at the last European Parliament election, many Europeans had the impression that they could just be bystanders in the US-China rivalry, continue to trade, you know. And for some sectors of the European economy, it's still more important to maintain access to the Chinese market, for example, European cars, than to worry too much about what's coming here in terms of imports from China, whereas others are far more worried about that. So there you see much more of the economics and the politics blending. And then on Middle East, this is, I think that here too, the election of the parliament is not going to make an enormous difference. Where I think it will matter internationally is on trade, as Andy was talking about earlier, and particularly on whether the EU now develops serious defence capabilities. If we do joint procurement, if there's a defence commissioner who starts up a real defence industrial strategy, that changes things a lot. And of course, we're all waiting to see what happens in the US. If Biden wins a second term, then there are a lot of things that the EU could do on the trade agenda, also on climate. There's, I think, a lot of scope for more of a joint climate agenda with the US. But then all bets are off if it's Trump.
There is really a lot at stake beyond just what happens in the parliament. From the way these elections show sentiment in Europe and how they relate to the U.S. and to China, and yes, the leadership in those other jurisdictions does affect things. Andy, for listeners who started here and then might be inspired to go back and listen to the full debate, how would you like this commentary to set people up who want to go back and hear for themselves what the parties had to say?
Well, I just think listen for the talking points. Listen for the – it's quite broad brush. You know, there's not too much geeky policy tools mentioned. So hopefully you will get a sense of whether these people know what they're talking about, whether you trust them with your future, your economic future. And you have, you know, a lot of differences there, you know, to choose from. And remember that in the EU, of course, everything is a coalition. You know, everything has to be agreed by consensus or by qualified majority voting. And therefore, it's not just one person. You know, three or four of these parties will have a say in every decision. So, you know, listen to the ones that you think are the most responsible, perhaps collaborate with others, and are sort of close to what you think is the right way forward. But, you know, I would encourage everyone. It's quite rare, I think, to find debates on a European level. I mean, we've discussed quite a bit here about member state versus European competence. And I think this debate was actually quite good at focusing on the European competence. So, you know, you are ultimately voting nationally, but you're also voting European-wide.
The coalition that brought you this podcast is the Financial Times and Bruegel. I am your host, Rebecca Christie. I'm a senior fellow here at Bruegel and a columnist for Writers Breaking Views. We are joined today by Andy Bounds, the Brussels correspondent for the Financial Times, who moderated the debate. Heather Graby, also at Bruegel, also senior fellow, really good on these political issues. And you can find her writing and many other wonderful things on our website, bruegel.org, where you can also find event recordings and many of these podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us, and see you next time.